Okay. As you can see, when you repeat these exercises, you come back into a consistent inner landscape, which will be different every time, but has consistent features. And it's sort of quite important to get this in a way that actually this, if you like, underneath underworld, otherworld. I mean, the Welsh used to call it Anuvin, which means the very deep place. Or the other way of understanding Anuvin would be the place that is not a place. You know, so it's a sort of very intimate, very direct level of human experience. But it has these kind of experiential qualities of being very deep and being placeless. So it's a strange, mysterious, you know, very mysterious place, yes. But as we relate to it, it relates back to us. So as we treat it seriously, so it treats us seriously. Now, we could treat it just at the level of fantasy, and it will appear fantasy to us, and we will go no further than that. If, however, we start to trust and relate to it, we start to explore it in deeper and deeper ways. And the other thing we start to discover is that in this descent and return, is that our sense of self and sense of world starts to reorganize itself. The outer sense of ourselves and the outer sense of our world gets a bit more fluid, a bit more responsive. Because we're entering into a more direct relationship with the mysterious nature of ourselves and the mysterious nature of the world we live in. We're opening things up in a sense, allowing a space, allowing a curiosity, allowing the sort of longing of our heart to sort of guide us, allowing our intentionality to be to be our guide. So the intention of discovery, the intention of, in this recent thing about following the, you know, in some ways we're looking, exploring, experientially exploring T.S. Eliot's Wasteland poem. But using that in a way to illuminate the wasteland within us, the mysterious nature within us, our relationship to life and death. So this is this act of commemoration, this act of remembrance that we're making. In a way, exploring our relationship to our own relationship to life and death, and the betrayals or fracturing of the world that has happened for us, that means that this is no longer a seamless, straightforward process. And in some ways, you know, the poem does it really well. It's a bleak poem, but actually it's not just bleak. You know, we begin with the kind of April the Querulous Month stuff and that we were looking at, and then what we've just looked at is this sense of longing for the longing, where is my Irish girl, the longing of the heart. And it comes really from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. And it's Eliot's images are always dual-edged, because the experience that we're looking at is dual-edged. In some one level, Tristan and Isolde shows us the hopeless, obsessive infatuations that lead to destruction. Because the story of Tristan and Isolde is a story where everything, you know, it's a doomed love affair that no good comes out of. In another way, it's this extraordinary, inspiring story of love that awakens the heart and that awakens your sense of the whole world. You know, the hyacinth image he uses later is also a very similar kind of image. Because, I mean, the poem keeps jumping, you know. So suddenly, you gave me hyacinth first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl. Yet when we came back late from the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak. My eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing. Looking into the heart of light, the silence. Void und leer das Meer, the desolate sea is empty. Complex. I mean, you know, you could spend weeks on these lines alone. Hyacinth the name Hyacinth comes out of Greek mythology. The beloved Hyacinth is this beautiful man, the beloved figure of Apollo, who is killed by a discus, and from whose blood springs the hyacinth flower. So you've got this image of great beauty, great longing, and death. So the beauty of the hyacinth comes out of the blood of hyacinth. Very interesting, very complicated stuff. I was neither living nor dead. Now that's a phrase that comes out of Dante to some extent. It's that phrase of being between the worlds. I was neither living nor dead. Looking into the heart of light, the silence. And in a way, that's strange conjunction. Are we looking into desolation? Are we looking into an empty silence? Got the another line from Wagner, the desolate sea is empty. I don't see my beloved coming over the waves. The desolate sea is empty. So it holds us in that place, really, where we are between worlds, and yet that place of longing between worlds, which includes pain and desolation, is also a place of pregnancy, a place of powerful life. So again, we're with this image of holding the opposites together. Very easy to read it just as a sort of, the whole Wasteland is like that. It's very easy to read it just as a poem of desolation. It really isn't. It is an alchemical, powerful alchemical poem, if held in a certain way. But of course it's a very powerful poem because it plunges us very directly into the experience of the Wasteland, and does it using modern imagery and in some ways it's more useful to me than some of the Grail texts when I look into this, because it uses images I can relate to. The beautiful, you know, the Wasteland in the Grail stories it's very poetic. You've got these withered trees, very beautiful. And, you know, rather lovely, really. But because it is a bit like looking at a sort of ancient, beautiful medieval manuscript, which actually you are literally looking at. And in some ways it's distanced from us, because the Wasteland is a very intimate place. It is that place of dryness, that place of deadness, that place of the loss of faith. And it's something very important to experience. And it is very powerfully the connection with death. One of the things you find knights happen, frequently what happens when a knight encounters a Grail chapel is there's a dead body in it. Yeah, that's the most frequent, and then a demonic force appears. And that's, you know, when that's said in medieval language, that's kind of easier to be with in some ways. It's like a nice picture from a distance. But what Eliot does is to plunge us directly into that experience somewhere. That sense of loss, that sense of dryness, that sense of hopeless longing. Now, what do you do with hopeless longing? What do you do with the longing for source? What do you do with the longing for love, or the longing for life to be different? What do you do with the longing for a decent socialist government after many years, for example? You know, and the thing that it's a very important thing, because longing is a profoundly motivating energy. In the Odyssey, it is that longing for home that sustains Odysseus through all his journeys and adventures. Without the longing is like the lodestone, the compass, really, that keeps him on track. So there's something here about really the power and the beauty of longing. Even the power of looking into the desolate sea. Then what happens, the poem makes another great jump, is we suddenly we're with Madame Sosostris, famous clairvoyant. He's just a great poet. Had a bard cold. It's suddenly with the banal. You know, so suddenly we're with You know, we're with this kind of beautiful image of the lost sea and Tristan and Isolde and longing. And suddenly we're with Madame Sosostris, fair Miss Clothwine, had a bard cold, nevertheless is known to be the wisest woman in Europe, with a wicked pack of cards. And here we're suddenly with the clairvoyance, we're with tarot cards, we're with again something that's very easily dismissed and very easily thought of as a nonsense. And yet, tarot cards in some ways really do represent the heap of images. Here are the old gods and the old goddesses reduced to a game, reduced to a card, but still they retain some of their ancient power. Because we have, he's very witty guy, Sosostris, so. You know, so there's this, because one of the features of clairvoyance is they never really tell you anything. They say, maybe like this, or then it might be like that. And you don't commit yourself, because if you commit yourself, if you're not a very good clairvoyant, you can be wrong, and then people don't come back. If you equivocate, you keep your punters. But what she says to the reader, here is your card, the drowned Phoenician sailor. Those are pearls that were his eyes, look. Here is Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. Now here suddenly we have an image of the drowned Phoenician sailor in a certain way is the image of the hanged god, the drowned god. The gods is Osiris, Adonis, is Christ, is the god who represents life and energy, who dies and keeps getting resurrected. Belladonna, Lady of the Rocks, is a reference to the Mona Lisa. So we have these suddenly from the personal reading, we suddenly are plunged into some of the deep archetypes underneath Western culture. We're with the Madonna of the Rocks, we're with Belladonna, which is a nice play on words, the beautiful woman of the rocks, the latter Gioconda, who is the Mona Lisa. Belladonna, also deadly poison. So there's a sort of, almost every line of this poem is edged with difference and opposites. But it's taking us into, right now, a deeper place through the medium of the tarot reader, who is simultaneously wise and banal, simultaneously wise, simultaneously a charlatan. And again, what this is showing us is if we go more deeply into these are the things we keep on encountering. We keep on encountering these opposites of banal. So Glastonbury for me is a great place to live in because of its chicanery and its depth. It's almost like having the Wasteland poem played out day by day. It's extraordinary, actually, because Glastonbury has these very powerful, very ancient mythic traditions that are genuinely very powerful, very strong. And day to day, mostly what you encounter is the horrible chicanery of Madame Sosostris, and literally so. There's lots of tarot readers in the town. If you go down the alleyway, just up here, just before you go into the overhang bit, there's a sign saying "The tarot never lies." Mm-hmm. And you just sort of, but here's Madame Sosostris again somewhere, you know, convincing people that whatever story is will be true, and yet somewhere she is this figure, this banality, this stuff that's so easy to dismiss, is the doorway into the drowned Phoenician sailor. These are pearls that were his eyes. This comes out of the Tempest, where. The Ferdinand, Prince of Naples, thinks his father is dead, and Ariel, who's the spirit helper of Prospero, tells him that he's in the deep, undergoing a tremendous transformation. So suddenly we're with this image of the drowned god, or the god who's hung upon the tree and is maybe drowned or buried, and is now undergoing a glorious transformation. So we're with this deep archetype, ancient archetype, long beyond Christ, goes back as far as something like Osiris, of the god who is destroyed and then returns in glorious kind of form, changed by the deep waters. So the image of the, you know, the being deep in the bottom of the sea, who is somehow changed by that imprisonment, confinement, by that alchemical, constant alchemical motion of the deep currents, the deep waves, who then emerges in glorious form. And suddenly we also have Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. We have this powerful kind of goddess image that comes up out of the depths. And then suddenly we're into, here is the man with three staves. This is a literal card from the Rider-Waite Tarot pack. And here is the wheel, here is the one-eyed merchant. And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find the hanged man, but fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking round in a ring. Thank you. So she's getting the money. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days. So you suddenly have these amazing shifts, right, from down, up, up and down. From the fortune teller grabbing your money to pronouncements about the hanged gods. And in a way, this is quite literal when we explore this dimension. You find this kind of, one moment you're touching something very superficial, one moment suddenly you're plunged down into the depths and you're touching something very profound that you don't understand. Next minute you're dealing with something really on the surface and sort of wanting your supper or wanting, you know, so it's that constant sort of movement. Where it takes us next is this phrase, unreal city. And we're back with Dante. There's a lot of Dante references in this. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many. I had not thought death had undone so many. That's a line out of Dante's Inferno. So we're talking about looking at the living dead. We're looking at the image of the city. And this is, again, the city is a great archetype, really. So the city is London. It is the city. It is the real city that Eliot works in. It's also the kind of the city of the dead or the city of the undead. Sighs short and infrequent are exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. I really, you know, get that image of the kind of day by day. We were talking about the pressure of work earlier and the sort of deadening effect of that. You know, so you really can feel that there. Then I saw one I know, and I stopped him crying, Stetson, you were with me in the ships at Millet. That corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year? Or has the sudden frost disturbed its bed? Will keep the dog far hence that's friend to men, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You, hypocrite lector, mon semblable, mon frère, means you, hypocrite reader, my look-alike, my brother. Corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout and has it begun to bloom? Will it bloom this year? So suddenly, from that living dead place, there's a sudden jump again. We're back down with the dead. We're back down with the revealing of the dead. Is this going to bloom yet? And just the injunction to leave it alone. Don't let it get disturbed too much. Let the dead bloom in its own way. You see, the thing is, when we work like this, we have to, you know, this movement between the banal and the profound, between the surface and the depth, is the journey that we encounter all the time. And a crucial part of this work is making the connection between these things. As I say, that's why Glastonbury for me is a really important, helps me a lot with this, because it helps me mostly by irritating me. And in that irritation, if I get irritated enough, I have to wake up a bit to the fact that it's wonderful, really. We even have gypsies. We have gypsies once or twice a week that come and want want to grab your hand and want you to give you kind of heather and want you to cross their palm with silver. And you, if you're a local, you learn, you keep your hands in your pockets when the gypsies are about, because they do the, because they rely on the natural, shake my hand, you're in your natural impetus, and once they've got you then, and then you're paying for it once you've done that, because they won't let go until you give them money. And so there's a certain way in which these, of course, very irritating, because they're just ripping you off. They're not giving you anything at all. They just want your money. Fair enough. You know, that's what they do. And yet, the image of the gypsy, the Romani, this is a powerful, mischievous kind of thing. And if we can let the semblance, if we can let ourselves not be trapped simply by the semblance of things, we can embrace both the way, both the banality and find the profundity within the banality, and vice versa. And in a way, that is this bridging function of human beings, where we connect opposites together. This is the center, and that's why the body and the imagination together are crucial. The imagination without strong root in the body is normally a dissociative imagination. It's imagination that splits. The imagination together with the body, however, becomes the living bridge between opposites. It is, in a way, the alchemical vessel within which the transformational processes happen. Now, what we see with Eliot's poem is it's not really a manual, this is a poem, but it's a real continual instruction upon this art of working with these opposites by in a toe-curling way identifying the aspects of the wasteland that speak so powerfully to our time. And he does, the next bit of the poem that comes on is something called the second part of the poem called The Game of Chess. And it really describes a very opulent room of quite a neurotic woman. Chair she sat in like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, with a glass held up with standards wrought from fruited vines, from which a golden cupidon peeped out. Another hid his eyes behind his wing, doubled the flames of seven-branched candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it. So you have this image of this neurotic woman with a sort of horribly baroque room, where he describes it, but who is simultaneously almost an image of the ancient goddess Isis sitting in her throne, sitting with the archetype, sitting with the deep energies. And he suddenly, and so you've got this powerful image where that's all described, and suddenly he talks about the change of Philomel by the barbarous king. Now Philomel, that's a whole story about the rape of a woman called Philomel by a barbarous king, and the terrible vengeance. So suddenly you've got this image of, you've got this image simultaneously neurotic and claustrophobic, and the ancient goddess Isis somewhere is sitting in front of you, and then suddenly we're in this sort of attack on femininity by the barbarous masculinity, and suddenly then we took and still she cried, and still the word pursues jug jug to dirty ears, and that's jug jug is simultaneously the song of the nightingale and jig a jig dirty, you know, sort of, it's a cry of sexuality, sort of accusation of prostitution. So he keeps on turning the tables on us somewhere. It's a very complicated, very interesting poem because of that. Because he as we move beyond the places of our longing, we start to touch into these collective kind of wounds and collective resources. So suddenly, you know, we have the hanged man, we have the god being transformed by the deep waters, waiting to return and bring the life of the world with him. We have the Belladonna lady, we have the Madonna of the rocks, who is simultaneously the beauty and poison. We have the neurotic woman who is also Isis. We have the despoiling of femininity, and somewhere we have the song of the nightingale, and sexual innuendo. And then suddenly we get a movement then into the questions of the neurotic woman. My nerves are barred tonight. Yes, barred. Stay with me. Speak to me. Why do you never speak? Speak. What are you thinking of? What thinking? What? I never know what you're thinking. Think. I think we're in Rat's Alley where dead men lost their bones. This is a vicious response. What is that noise? It's the wind under the door. What is that noise now? What's the wind doing? Nothing again, nothing. Do you know nothing? Do you see nothing? Do you remember? Nothing. I remember pearls that were his eyes. Are you alive or not? Is there nothing in your head? But oh, that Shakespearean rag. It's so elegant, so intelligent. What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down so. What shall we do tomorrow? What do we ever do? The hot water at 10, and if it rains, a closed card 4. And we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door. It's chilling, that last bit. Now, the neurotic woman, the hysterical woman, as she appears here, is a kind of interesting sort of figure. Dual-edged. The thing about hysteria, the thing about this image of the hysterical woman, which of course in Western culture is in Western European culture, is an image of pushing away the intuitive, pushing away the emotional. Don't be so emotional. God, she's getting hysterical now. It's a very powerful image of the suppression of the whole part of our nature that we're looking at. It is always has been very interesting for me that Freud's work is all about neurosis, and mostly his patients are neurotic women who come to him suffering hysterical paralysis. And if we remember when Freud was practicing in the late part of the 19th century, the high water mark of patriarchy, the high water mark of colonialism, the place where the feminine is almost completely pushed out of the world, so pushed out of the world that women's bodies are becoming paralyzed. It's an incredible, so this bit of the poem is an incredibly evocative aspect of a potent wound of human nature. The attack upon the feminine, and the rejection and the expulsion out of the world and out of the body of the feminine, the extent that the feminine body starts to become paralyzed. And you know, it's a bit easier for us to think of Jung these days because he's in some ways can be perceived as a more interesting figure than Freud. But Freud is absolute dynamite when he appears, because what we see Freud doing is speaking out for the irrational, the whole world of Freudian work has become so assimilated now that the radical nature of it is forgotten. Because he's writing at a time when really the rational mind is absolutely dominant and the domination of men over women is absolutely profound. And what he says to the whole world, hang on a minute, there's a whole other place, there's a place called the unconscious. And this unconscious is full of suppressed desire and longing, the id or the itness of the deep psyche. Is a cauldron of life and energy and passion and power, and unless you come to terms with this, the life doesn't go well. You are cut off from the springs of life. He identifies the Oedipal complex, which is this construction that arises out of Western society of the complex dynamics of the nuclear family, of the of the dis and of and you know the Oedipal complex is profoundly related to patriarchy. It is about the desire of the man to kill his father and become king in his place, and the woman in the Oedipal complex is a tool, an object of that process. So it's a profound. So he's seeing this very profound wound that is the cultural wound that has become inbuilt into the psyche in such a way that human relationship is profoundly distorted. So Eliot in some way really shows us, swings us back into that actually in a certain sense we treat the ancient goddess Isis as an neurotic hysterical woman. We keep her locked up in her stifling room, instead of if you look at a Greco-Roman work, Golden Ass of Lucius Apuleius. The god, this is a woman who can, the goddess Isis cannot be confined. She's the goddess of 10,000 names, who rises out of the sea and is as big as the universe, and who brings all the perfumes of Arabia with her, who brings this powerfully embodied sense of the living world. And in this poem, what we have done with her is shut her up in a room, crammed all the sacred objects together. She's got synthetic perfumes because we are keeping her in this room. And we will, and her cry, her demand to be released, is treated as neurotic nonsense. And, you know, the whole problem with patriarchy is that we are all, man, women, all of us, we're all indoctrinated in this. So there are places where we keep her in a small place, maybe in a frozen place. Actually, we let her out. Now then, what happens? Who knows? Powerful, mysterious. Salome, you know, Jung's version of the blind Salome. Blinded, impossible to trust, too tricksy. So there's a whole area here, as we come into this part of ourselves, as we seek, if you like, the grail, the place that heals, we encounter what we have done with the source of life, what we have done with the divine feminine, the box that we have put her in. And the way out of that is to listen to what appears to be the neurotic cries. You know, the sort of, I lose, you know, countless times people tell me, I mean, just being self-indulgent, they come to my therapy practice, I'm just being self-indulgent, or they tell you some terrible bloody story of pain and just say, well, I'm all right really, you know, and you know, they've just sort of shown you some desolation of their life, and rather than stay with that, rather than be with that, there's it's treated as neurotic nonsense. I just need to pull myself together. So, you know, I just need to pull myself together. And so that's, you know, these energies, the contrary energies to the work that we're talking about, are very strong. So as we try to go into the deep places, these are the voices that we meet. These are the kind of challenges. And in a way, Eliot's poem is a tremendous help for this sort of. You know, if I think of myself, I was thinking the other day, what do I draw upon in my own practice of therapy? Wasteland is one of the things I draw upon, and Franz Kafka's work is probably the other. I don't really draw from therapy books. You know, they're not unuseful, I suppose, but I don't find them, but they don't really inspire me anymore. But the places I go back to, Kafka is stunning on the bureaucratization of the self and the ways in which we can trap ourselves, but in some ways the Wasteland, I think, for me is more profound because it speaks much more powerfully also to this cultural dimension. You know, and he jumps from this scene of the kind of this desperate game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door, desperate for something to happen. He's suddenly in a pub scene. And again, we've got something terrible about, again, male-female relationships. And in a way, in terms of the poem, in a sense, the person watching all this, in a way, from a distance, is this prophet Tiresias, is this being, mysterious, blind seer, who is both male and female, almost looking kind of curiously at these extraordinary distortions. When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, so we're suddenly in a pub. When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words, I said to myself. Then you've got this other voice, hurry up, please, it's time. Now Albert's coming back. Make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you'd done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did. I was there. You have them all out, Lil, and get a nice set, he said. I swear I can't bear to look at you. And no, can't I, said. And think of poor Albert. He's been in the army 4 years. He wants a good time. And if you don't give it to him, there's others that will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Something of that, I said. And then I'll know who to thank, she said, and gave me a straight droop. Hurry up, please, it's time. If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't. But if Albert makes off, it won't be for lack of telling. You should be ashamed, I said, to look so antique. That's a very crucial line. You should be ashamed to look so antique. Because here we have this sense of modernity and the escaping away from the antique. And you know, you have the beginnings of cosmetic surgery here, where they get your own, you know, get yourself a nice set of teeth. And her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling a long face. It's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. She's had five already and nearly died of young George. Chemist said it'll be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is, I said. What do you get married for if you don't want children? Oh yeah, please, it's time. Well, that Sunday, Albert was home. They had a hot gammon. They asked me in to dinner to get the beauty of it hot. Hurry up, please, it's time. Hurry up, please, it's time. Oh, well, good night, Bill. Good night, Lou. Good night, May. Good night, ta-ta. Good night, good night. Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night, good night. Suddenly we're in Hamlet. And the line from of the death of Ophelia. Extraordinary poem. Right? So suddenly we're jumping between these worlds. We're suddenly with... You know, Albert and Lil's marriage, and you know, and sort of, we don't hold up much hope personally, at least I don't. And then suddenly we're with Ophelia in the waters, and that plunge into the night, plunge into death again. And this interesting line of, you shouldn't look antique. And so antique, in a way, is the ancientness, is the underneath of things, is the deep of things. Put a nice face on, buy yourself some nice teeth. Then Albert will want you. Maybe. But we end, really, with Ophelia. We end also with, it's time. Hurry up, please, it's time. You know, suddenly we're with death again. We're at the end of the evening. It's all over, it's time. Sorry, it's time. Now is your time. And then we make another jump, the fire sermon. Suddenly we're with the Buddha. We're at fire, and it's not mentioned at all directly, but the fire sermon of the Buddha, where the whole, this great thing in the sutras where the Buddha talks about the whole world is on fire. You're going to sit in a burning house and you believe in its permanence, but actually the whole world is on fire. Your senses are on fire. Everything you grab is on fire. Your desire to hold, you're trying to hold a burning house together. And we're given an image of the polluted Thames. The river's tent is broken. The last fingers of leaf clutch and sink into the wet bank. The wind crosses the brown land unheard. The nymphs are departed. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. The rivers bear no empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, or other testimony of summer nights. The nymphs are departed. And their friends, the loitering heirs of city directors, departed, have left no addresses. By the waters of Leman, I sat down and wept. Now, Leman is a lake in Switzerland. Leman is also the word for lover. And of course, it's a reference to by the waters of Babylon. I sat down and wept for the lost Jerusalem. Sweet Thames, run softly till I end my song. Sweet Thames, run softly, for I speak not loud or long. But at my back, in a cold blast, I hear the rattle of the bones and chuckle spread from ear to ear. A rat crept softly through the vegetation, dragging its slimy belly on the bank, while I was fishing in the dull canal. Suddenly we're with death, suddenly we're with the kind of the rattle of the bones. And suddenly I am fishing in the dull canal. Now, this is a reference to the Fisher King of the Grail myths. So suddenly we jump from the literal to the archetypal again. So here we have the fisher king fishing for the and fish are all about life, but fishing in the dull canal. On a winter's evening, round about behind the gas house, musing upon the king, my brother's wreck, and on the king, my father's death before him. White bodies naked on the low, damp ground, and bones cast in a little low, dry garret. Rattled by the rat's foot only year to year, but at my back from time to time, I hear the sound of horns and motors, which shall bring Sweeney to Mrs. Porter in the spring. Oh, the moon shone bright on Mrs. Porter and on her daughter. They wash their feet in soda water. Et aux ces voix des enfants chantant dans la coupole. Twit, 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 jug, 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 so rudely forced. There's a lot in all this, right? But the, again, what he brings us to, he suddenly brings us into the territory of the Fisher King. We've got also this sense of the foot washing, which is simultaneously a famous brothel keeper, Mrs. Porter. And we've got the Sweeney, who is a sort of mad Sweeney, who is actually a figure out of medieval folklore, who is a kind of, again, another mad prophet kind of figure. So we've got this strange, if you like, union of opposites, being the brothel keeper and the mad prophet. We've got Salome and Elijah again. And we've got the Fisher King looking for life in the waters of the dull canal. And we have the foot washing. And so somewhere we're also with Christ washing the feet of the disciples. So again, we're with this profound sense of remembrance, of bringing things together, of bringing opposites together. And what, you know, Eliot is just doing this out of the fabric of his own life, out of the fabric of his own knowing. I mean, in some ways, one of the problems of this poem is the erudition in it. Because you can get a bit lost in that if you're not careful. Because there's also, especially for me, there's all these enticing references, and I can fly off from them. But actually, what he's continually doing, he's circling. It's the spiral of that diagram. We're spiraling around something, getting closer and closer into something. Suddenly, we come back to, we've got this phrase tero, which is this is the rape of a Philemon. It's just a phrase, just there, suddenly. So suddenly we're reminded of rape and violation. And then we're back with the phrase, the unreal city. And then the same line, under the brown fog of a winter moon, Mr. Eugenides, the Smyrna merchant, unshaven with a pocket full of currants, CIF London, documents at sight, asked me in demotic French to luncheon at the Cannon Street Hotel, followed by a weekend at the Metropole. So we've got Mr. Eugenides, who's the Smyrna merchant, who's sort of the merchant from Asia Minor, the place where the East and the West come together. He's another version of the kind of the one-eyed merchant that we came across earlier, propositioning our speaker, offering them at luncheon and a dirty weekend at the Metropole. And then suddenly there's a whole thing about back at the Violet Hour. We have a whole thing about the life of a clerk typist at the Violet Hour, coming home from work. At the Violet Hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi throbbing waiting. Suddenly Tiresias appears in the middle of the poem again. I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour, the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from the sea. The typist home at tea time clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the warp window, perilously spread, her trying combinations, touched by the sun's last rays, on the divan are piled, at night her bed. Stockings, slippers, camisoles and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I too awaited the expectant guest. He, the young man, Carbuncular, arrives. A small house agent's clerk with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits, as a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. That horrible, horribly snobbish comment. As a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended, she is bored and tired. Endeavours to engage her in caresses, which are still unreproved, if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defence, his vanity requires no response, and makes a welcome of indifference. And I, Tiresias, have foresuffered all, enacted on this small divan or bed. I who have sat by Thebes below the wall, this is the Oedipus reference, and walked among the lowest of the dead, this is Odysseus. Makes a welcome of indifference, and I, Tiresias, have foresuffered all, enacted on this same divan or bed, I who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead. Bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done, and I'm glad it's over. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces around about her room alone, she smoothes her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. Now here we have him again bringing Tiresias in, again in the middle of this, you know, banal little sexual encounter. Tiresome, boring, terrible, really. And in the middle of it, underneath, sort of by the divan, we have Tiresias, reminding us of Oedipus and Odysseus. In the middle of the most banal, meaningless encounter, somewhere he sings of Oedipus, the tragedy of Oedipus and the achievement of Odysseus. And then suddenly it drifts again. The music crept by me along the waters and along the strand of Queen Victoria Street. Oh, city, city, I can sometimes hear, beside a public bar in Lower Thames Street, the pleasant whining of a mandolin. And a chatter, chatter from within, where fishermen lounge at noon, where the walls of Magnus Martyr, the great martyr, hold the inexplicable splendour of Ionian white and gold. So suddenly out of banality we're suddenly with mandolins playing, we're suddenly with gleams of Ionian white and gold, we're suddenly with fishermen home from the sea. It's a powerful shift. Make a bit of a jump, really, the fourth thing, fear death by water. The drowned Phoenician. Phlebas the Phoenician, a fortnight dead, forgot the cry of gulls and the deep sea swell and the profit and loss. A current and a sea picked his bones in whispers. As he rose and fell, he passed the stages of his age and youth, entering the whirlpool. Gentile or Jew, or you who turned the wheel and looked to windward, consider Phlebas, who was once handsome and tall as you. We're in a different rhythm now. We're sort of out of the heat and the back and forth of the kind of opposites. We're in the mysterious drowned man, Phlebas the Phoenician. We're in the forgetting of the upper world, and the strange transformation entering the whirlpool. It's the whirlpool, the spiral of the diagram. And we're asked, those of us who turn the wheel and look to windward, the great phrase. Because in a way, the reference here really is to those of us who are swimming on the deep waters, who are working with the winds of the world, who turn the wheel. You could say that's also a Buddhist reference to the Buddha turning the wheel. Look to windward, turn the wheel. Consider Phlebas, consider the drowned Phoenician sailor who is being transformed by the turning whirlpool. Now, whirlpool again is an interesting thing. It's another great image of this spiral glyph. It has an axis that everything turns around, and it is a spiral. In this case, taking you down and down and down and down, but around a central axis. So it is in itself an image of the straight and the spiral. Again, an image of a transforming vortex that turns the drowned man into something mysterious and glorious, where his eyes become pearls, his bones become coral. He is this deep figure of the deep sea that then rises to bring new life. And we are jumped suddenly in the next part of the poem, what the thunder said, into the passion of Christ. So suddenly we come from the drowned Phoenician sailor, the God who is underneath the waters, who is being transformed. We come into a more direct encounter with the image of Christ. What the thunder said, after the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation, of thunder of spring over distant mountains, he who is living is now dead. We who are living are now dying with a little patience. And we plunge into the wasteland again. Here is no water but only rock, rock and no water and the sandy road. The road winding above the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink. Amongst the rock, one cannot stop or think. Sweat is dry and feet are in the sand. If there were only water among the rock. Dead mountain mouth, the rot of carious means rotting teeth that cannot spit. Here one can neither stand nor lie nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red, sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. We're in the red desert. We're in the land of Set, the fire of the desert, where there is no welcome, there is no kindness, there is only heat and desolation. If there were water and no rock, and if there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock, if there were the sound of walk so only, not the cicada and dry grass singing, but sound of water over a rock, where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip drop, drop drop, drip drop, drop drop drop, but there is no water. So again, we're with the longing for water. Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there is only you and I together. Whenever I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman, but who is that on the other side of you? It's a reference to Christ on the road to Emmaus. It's a reference to the mysterious that is in the desolate place, in the red land, in the land without water. We are accompanied. What is that sound high in the air? Murmur of maternal lamentation. Who are these hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? What is that city over the mountains, cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air? In the violet air, rather. Falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London. Unreal. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper on those strings, and bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings, and crawled head downward down a blackened wall, and upside down in air were towers, tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours, and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. Again, you feel the exhaustion, the upside downness of things, the emptiness of well and cistern. And then suddenly we come up to the Grail Chapel. In this decayed hole among the mountains, in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing. Over the tumbled graves, about the chapel, there is the empty chapel, only the wind's home. It has no windows and the door swings. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the roof tree. Cocorico, cocorico, cock-a-doodle-doo. In a flash of lightning, then a damp gust bringing rain. Ganja was sunken and the limp leaves waited for rain, while the black clouds gathered far distant over Himvanant. The jungle crouched, humped in silence, then spoke the thunder. Da! Data, what have we given? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender, which an age of prudence can never retract. By this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries, or in memories draped by the beneficent spider, or under seals broken by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. Da! Dayadhavam, I have heard the key. Turn in the door once and turn once only. We think of the key each in his prison. Thinking of the key each confirms a prison. Only at nightfall, ethereal rumours revive for a moment a broken Coriolanus. Da! Damyata! The boat responded gaily to the hand, expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm, your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. I sat upon the shore, fishing with the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. Poi chiuse nel foce cigala fina. Quando fia muti celidon, o swallow, swallow, le prince de Aquitaine alla tour abolli. These fragments I have shored against my ruins. Why then, il fit you, hineramos mad again. Data, diadvam, damyata, shanti, shanti, shanti. Now this final piece, full final piece of the poem, really brings us to an apotheosis, really brings us to a real deep change. We encounter we encounter Phlebas, the drowned Phoenician sailor. We are Phlebas, we are in that whirlwind, we are in that deep place, even as we are on the surface of the water steering the ship. We are both Phlebas and the person guiding the ship, turning the wheel. As we enter into that mystery, we encounter the arrest and the death of the Christ figure. We encounter the dying God. We are plunged into the burning wasteland, into out of the most powerful version of the wasteland. We're back in the dry desert of Egypt. We're back in the territory of Set the Destroyer. We're back in the place, the longing for water. And we can do nothing other than long. We are in this place where we have to keep on walking through the wasteland, being in the burning, being with the longing, being with that fullness, that longing for water, almost the hallucinogenic imagining of water that isn't there. But in that place there is a third who walks beside us, so there is guidance in that place. So when we're in these deep, traumatized, traumatic places, there is a companion, mostly unseen and always unrecognized. And there is this sense of this image of the city over the mountains. It could be Jerusalem, there could be Athens, there could be Alexandria, there could be Vienna, there could be London. The unreal, real city, the city of God, the city that represents the place of of the union of nature and humanity, the union of opposites, the Jerusalem descended to the earth, the place of living peace, fed by the spring of life, lit by the tree of life in the middle of the garden, in the middle of the city. So suddenly, that comes to us as we are in the midst of the dry desert. And maybe we can only see this place clearly at first when we're in the middle of the burning desert. Because what happens then, we come into this very sinister place. We come to this fiddle whisper music on these strings, baby-faced bats in violet light, whistling, beating their wings, crawling head downwards down a blackened wall with upside-down towers, reminiscent bells, and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. Horrible, frightening. And then there we come to Chapel Perilous, we come to the Gateway of the Gael, we come to the Grail, the place that looks like a decayed, empty hole where there is nothing there. But in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing. Something new is here, faint, like the singing of grass in moonlight. And then there is, if we can let ourselves go into that place, encounter the absence of life in that place, encounter the death and the devils that live there, we can hear the cry of the cockerel, the flash of lightning, and the coming of the rain, and the coming of the thunder, and the voice that speaks out of the thunder. And that voice asks us to give ourselves to the moment, datta. Be present, give yourself into the moment, surrender, the awful daring of a moment, surrender. And boom, da, the thunder noise again. Dyadavam, I've heard the key, the love of others, the feeling of the other means compassion. It's the energy of, so having surrendered, becoming present, then if we have compassion, and stop thinking just of our key and our prison, but have compassion for others, then something else happens. While we continually think of our prison and the key to our prison alone, we remain imprisoned. Da! Then Damyata, the boat response. Then we require this place of mastery over the boat, of our vehicle. And then this is a quality that you find written of in the Odyssey. It's a quality called metis, which is this ability to become one with boat, one with phone, one with hammer. To that deep quality of the will and the imagination, where you surrender yourself into the world, into being in touch with things, and you acquire an intuitive mastery by being at one with things. It's the metis is this quality of the. I mean, the image is in Odysseus is either the charioteer who's at one with the horse and the horse and the chariot, or at one with the sea and the waves, and who works with these things in order to bring us home to Sho. And Sho is that place of shanti, shanti, shanti. And we're given this image right at the end of the girl. I sat upon the shore fishing with the arid plains behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? These fragments I have shored against my ruins. And it's the, in the end, it is, he doesn't mind the fact that they're fragments. We've got Haramo's mad again. It's all right to be mad again, even. It's all right to have all the fragments. Datta deyavadam damyata. Shanti, shanti, shanti. So it ends actually in a place of profound hope, this poem of despair. You know, he gets beyond, he does get into the Grail Chapel, he does hear the voice of the thunder. And there is still fragments, there is still madness, and shanti, shanti, shanti. So it isn't a static peace that's found at the end here. It's the capacity to work with wind and water. It's the capacity to hear the voice of the thunder, to give yourself into the moment, to have your heart continually broken open, to have the empty-handed mastery of trusting the moment and opening to it and working with the energies of the world, not in opposition, to make peace. So shanti is that capacity to make peace with all the opposites, however they constellate, and they always constellate differently and immediately. It's that heart capacity to give yourself to that, to be open to that wider field, and in that moment to be master of the field. There's a lot more I could say about this poem, but that's enough. We've done a lot of you've sat there very patiently while I've kind of hammered you through it. Right, but it's all profoundly connected, directly connected to this work, internal work that we're talking about. And if you have an interest in poetry at all, it's certainly an interest in this work. It's one of the great resources, but it doesn't look like it. You read it, you talk about, when you read it, it sounded like it was a very powerful, depressing, difficult thing for you. I'll just turn the thing off.